To keep streams in the Pocono Mountains pristine, environmentalists have pushed for more protections.
It might cost you a little bit more, but it's not saying that you can't develop here. You have to be thoughtful about how far back from the river you're building.
But businesses that rely on tourism dollars say the rules are too strict. I'm Kara Holsapple. This week on the Allegheny Front, the fight over water in the Poconos. Plus, a federal program that's created community ball fields and funded national parks is going to expire unless Congress acts.
There's no taxpayer dollars in this. This is like a no-brainer for us to take action on this.
And we tag along with some serious orchid hunters in West Virginia.
Here's a Lazara.
I'll be darned. Where? I don't see it.
Oh, there it is.
Those and more environmental stories are coming up on the Allegheny Front. Stay with us. President Trump has unveiled his plan to replace the Obama administration's signature climate initiative, known as the Clean Power Plan. President Trump's replacement is part of a promise to revive the nation's ailing coal industry, though industry experts say that's unlikely to happen. State Impact Pennsylvania's Marie Cusick has more.
The Clean Power Plan assigned each state emission reduction targets to phase in through 2030. Pennsylvania would have been required to reduce its carbon emissions by about 33%. The new proposal creates guidelines for how states should require power plants to become more efficient, and it gives states more leeway to craft a plan based on specific power plants within their borders. Bill Wareham, EPA's Assistant Administrator for the Office of Air and Radiation, said under the Obama-era plan, the agency was overstepping its authority under the Clean Air Act.
However much people may want EPA to regulate power grids, however much people may want EPA to demand that new renewable energy be built instead of fossil fuel plants, we do not have that authority under this part of the Act.
Environmental advocates said the new rule hinders the progress the country's made reducing climate-damaging greenhouse gases. Among states, Pennsylvania is the third largest emitter of carbon. Marie Cusick, State Impact Pennsylvania.
The idea that a climate plan would prop up coal plants isn't a surprise coming from President Trump. We all know by now that Trump is skeptical about the effects of carbon emissions and the science of climate change. And he's not alone. A Pew study found only 11% of conservative Republicans say climate scientists really understand the causes of climate change. For our podcast, Trump on Earth, the Allegheny Front's Reed Frazier spoke with Bob Inglis last year. He's a former South Carolina Republican congressman who now heads Republic EN, a group of conservatives who accept that climate change is caused by us.
Can you explain your own evolution on climate change and kind of how you got to where you are today?
For my first 6 years in Congress, I was, consistent with the tribe. Climate change was nonsense because Al Gore was for it, particularly since I represented such a conservative district in South Carolina. Then I was out of Congress for 6 years doing commercial real estate law again and ran for Congress again in 2004. My son came to me. He was voting for the first time. He just turned 18. He's the oldest of our five kids. And so he said to me, "Dad, I'll vote for you, but you're going to clean up your act on the environment." By the way, my son was not making a classic interest group threat. He was going to vote for me no matter what. But what he was really saying was, "Dad, I love you, and you can be better than you were before. So how about let's make this Inglis 2.0, the new and improved version?" So that was step one. Step two was getting on the science committee, going to Antarctica, seeing the evidence in the ice core drillings. Step three was another science committee trip, Great Barrier Reef, snorkeling with an Aussie climate scientist named Scott Heron. And I could tell that Scott and I shared a worldview before any words were spoken, because I could see that he was worshiping God in what he was showing me. St. Francis of Assisi said, "Preach the gospel at all times. If necessary, use words." And so afterwards, we had a chance to talk, and he told me about conservation changes he was making in his life to love God and love people. And I got right inspired by that. So I came home and, wanting to be like Scott, introduced the Raise Wages, Cut Carbon Act of 2009, probably not very good political timing to introduce a carbon tax in the midst of the Great Recession. And it didn't help me that it's revenue neutral, which means you cut taxes somewhere else. It was just that I had crossed to the other tribe. I'd been seen as being untrue to my own tribe in the midst of that Great Recession.
So is that it? I mean, is it really just tribal? I mean, one of the reasons I was really excited to have you on was because I'm really fascinated by this question of why don't Republicans believe the science on climate change? And to be clear for our listeners, the science on climate change is clear. We're warming the planet. The primary reason is carbon dioxide. But a lot of Republicans and conservatives think this is a not settled science. Is it really, since Democrats think this is a problem, we are not going to think this is a problem?
Well, I think that it's that we conservatives have a very undeserved inferiority complex. We think we're no good when it comes to energy and climate. And so when the topic comes up, we tend to shrink in science denial when we should be engaging because we're actually very good. We've got the answer. We know from people like Milton Friedman, a great father of conservatism, that what you do about pollution, well, you tax it, of course. If you pair that with a dollar-for-dollar reduction in other taxes or dividend all the new carbon tax revenue back to the people, it's revenue neutral, which is attractive to conservatives. And then, of course, you apply it to imports, and it makes it attractive because it means that you're making it in the world's interest to follow American leadership there. So it starts, I think, with an inferiority complex. And then it continues on with this. As conservatives, we haven't seen a solution that we like yet. And so what we have here is sounds like I'm a psychiatrist here, doesn't it? Another psychological issue, which is that we have something called solution aversion. We think that the solution is going to be a larger government that taxes us, that regulates us, that takes away liberty, that grows an anti-state. And so we reject the existence of the problem. And that sounds crazy, maybe, to some, to, you know, dismiss the existence of a problem if you don't like the solution. But here's a plan of surgery for that back problem you're having. First, we're going to remove your head. After we've got your head off, we work on your spine. Then we're going to put your head back on. You're going to say to me, thanks, doc, I'm feeling a lot better. I don't have a back problem because the solution is nuts. And so in the case of climate, conservatives have heard, you know, some people running around with their hair on fire saying that we got to shut down industries and we got to stop the economy, stop all the gears from turning. Well, no wonder they're going to say, well, the solution's nuts. But what we live to show them at republicen.org is a very different solution that is actually a smaller government that simply puts the price in on all the fuels. In other words, adds all of their hidden cost to the fuels in a transparent, accountable marketplace, and then eliminates all the subsidies. Then there's a level playing field on which fuels compete. And the liberty of enlightened self-interest, consumers will pursue their self-interest, and the result will be cleaner air and fixing the climate change problem.
The Allegheny Front's Reed Frazier spoke with former South Carolina Republican Congressman Bob Inglis last year for our podcast, Trump on Earth. There's a lot more of their conversation at trumponearth.org. And you'll find dozens of great interviews with other politicians, policymakers, researchers, and journalists there too, as we try to understand the changes to environmental policy under the Trump administration. Fresh episodes of the podcast return soon, so now is your chance to catch up. That's trumponearth.org. This is the Allegheny Front. I'm Carol Holsapple. Do you have a hobby that consumes you or a passion that you're planning to pursue once you retire? Well, then orchid mania might resonate with you.
I mean, we hunted them from Alaska to Newfoundland. Some people play golf. We did North American orchids, so we were just orchid crazy.
Later on the Allegheny Front, we go orchid hunting in West Virginia with true aficionados. Stay tuned. Some of the cleanest streams in eastern Pennsylvania run through the Pocono Mountains, attracting tourists and providing clean water to cities downstream. Environmentalists pushed state regulators to increase protections of these streams. But local businesses and resort owners say these new protections could hamper the growth of the very tourism that that clean water attracts. State Impact Pennsylvania's Catalina Jaramillo traveled to Monroe County, where the battle over these waterways begins.
Tank Creek runs through the heart of the Pocono Mountains, carrying some of the cleanest water in Pennsylvania downstream into the Delaware River. The creek is home to native plants, and it attracts bears, deer, and birds. The surrounding forest keeps the water cool, and the creek is loaded with wild trout. You can't see any houses or people from here.
I find solitude here in the stream, in the forest, in the wildlife, in the fish.
Trout fishermen, like Rob Shane, want to keep it this way.
You spend too much time around people. You need places like this close by to kind of keep your sanity.
Shane works with the conservation group Trout Unlimited. Along with a coalition of local environmental groups, he has pushed state regulators to boost protections for Tank Creek and a half dozens like it in Monroe County. Recently, he got his wish.
It's so important to protect these headwater streams. You know, the Poconos rely so heavily on tourism to drive it economically. Having places like this for people to come and see, you know, we lose this, we lose pretty much everything. Nobody's going to want to come here.
But a group of local businessmen and landowners don't like the new approach to these streams in the Poconos. So they sued the Department of Environmental Protection. One businessman who opposes the new creek protections is Nick Igdalski, who runs the Pocono Raceway. And he loves racing cars.
Right now we're entering the track. We're in between turns 2 and 3 of the raceway. And we're going to step on the gas a little bit.
Pocono Raceway, also known as the Tricky Triangle, hosts 2 NASCAR races every summer, bringing 75,000 visitors each weekend. The raceway's 2,500 acres of land are crossed by the Tunkhannock Creek, which is one of the creeks that could get extra protections. Meaning, if Igdalski wants to develop near it, he might have to jump through more hoops and spend more money to make sure pollutants don't run off into the stream.
We may have to spend X amount more to adhere to the runoffs, but there's also the chance that we won't be able to do anything at all, depending on what the project is. So it limits your scope. We have 2,500 acres of commercial land, of which a significant slice of would be virtually unusable to us.
Igdalski grew up in the Poconos. In addition to fast cars, he also loves the outdoors, just like trout fisherman Rob Shane. And he works hard to make Pocono Raceway more sustainable, recycling tires, oil, car batteries, and waste. He even installed a solar farm to reduce his carbon footprint.
You know, you're in a beautiful, pristine wilderness that caters to wilderness adventure tourism. Why wouldn't you want to keep the area beautiful?
But Igdalski says the new protections given to the streams go too far. He worries that it would limit future development projects. And he's not alone. Owners of big resorts like Pocono Manor, Kalahari, and Camelback are running ads in local newspapers. They're fighting back against the environmentalists and the new stream protections. Abby Jones is a lawyer for Penn Future, an environmental group that pushed for the new stream classifications. She says special protections would not prevent landowners from developing new projects, but it does mean they would have to preserve the stream.
It might cost you a little bit more. In some cases, yes, you might not be able to do exactly what you want, but it's not saying that you can't develop here. It's not saying you can't do the development that you want. You just have to be thoughtful about your wastewater treatment plan that you're putting in. You have to be thoughtful about how far back from the river you're building. That's all it is.
The Department of Environmental Protection says the streams need extra attention to maintain their current pristine quality, including supporting wild trout. And they say the developers are jumping the gun because none of them have asked permission to do any specific new projects. Meanwhile, the case is winding its way through the court. Catalina Jaramillo, State Impact, Pennsylvania.
conservationists are mobilizing to save a pot of money that helps pay for things like access to clean streams, hiking trails, and parks. Ed Perry is the Pennsylvania Outreach Coordinator for the National Wildlife Federation, and he wants Congress to reauthorize a program that funds federal, state, and local projects.
I call the Land and Water Conservation Fund the best conservation program that most people have never heard of.
Perry worked as a biologist at the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service for decades and says up until a few years ago, he wasn't even aware of the program's reach. The Land and Water Conservation Fund was established by Congress in 1964, and it's funded with royalty payments from the oil and gas industry.
And the purpose was to preserve, create, and ensure access to outdoor recreation facilities to strengthen the health of all Americans. Over the past 50 years or so, there's been like 40,000 projects all across the country that have been funded. Here in Pennsylvania, we've been lucky. There's been 1,500 projects all across the state to the tune of $315 million, like expansions of state game lands, access to streams for fishermen, playgrounds, swimming pools, expansions of rails to trails. Anything you can think to do with outdoor recreation has likely got some Land and Water Conservation Fund money in it.
I believe the land for the Flight 93 National Memorial was purchased with this fund.
Yes, that's exactly right. There's $10 million in the Flight 93 Memorial. Just about all the Civil War battlefields, Gettysburg, Valley Forge, Antietam, that also has Land and Water Conservation Fund money in it. There's what's called a Forest Legacy Program. There's state matching grants for that also. And this helps landowners who are, some of them are in trouble financially. So they use this money to help them manage their forest, which, of course, is a benefit to wildlife and fish.
So this program is set to sunset on September 30th. Is there really a danger that it won't be reauthorized by Congress?
It'd be like predicting what the stock market is going to do. We never know what this Congress will do. There appears to be still some strong bipartisan support on this. But when you think back over time what Congress has done with the money, if you would total up all the money for the past 54 years or so that the LWCF has been in operation, we should have gotten $48 billion. Instead, almost half of that has been diverted to other uses. There should be a pot of money that is permanently there every year per the legislation and that the state and federal governments can access for projects for outdoor recreation and for fish and wildlife conservation.
How many times has it been reauthorized?
Well, the first time it was reauthorized for 25 years, and then another 25-year reauthorization. And then in September of 2015, they only reauthorized it for 3 years. And I'm not sure why that happened. I'm suspicious that some of the Western congressmen don't like Land and Water Conservation Fund monies going to public lands out west. There's no taxpayer dollars in this. This is like a no-brainer for us to take action on this. This is something that the drillers owe the people of the United States for polluting the Gulf of Mexico and for taking a public resource that belongs to all Americans. I grew up, you know, in the early 50s in Cleveland, Ohio, overlooking the steel mills. And my ball field was a weedy field next to a busy highway where we couldn't hit the left field because we might hit a car, break a car windshield. And here today, we have this great program that has benefited so many Americans. This program is the reason why their kids can go to these parks, why we have these great national parks, Yellowstone, the Everglades, Acadia. All of these have Land and Water Conservation Fund money in them.
Well, what do you say to critics of the program, like the Conservative Heritage Foundation, who say the fund has been popular with lawmakers because they associate it with those local parks, but that it expands federal land and control over land and water that would be better managed by state and local officials?
Well, some of these legislators have advocated that they take over these public lands or sell them off. There has been pushback within their own legislators saying there is no way that we have the taxpayer dollars to manage these lands like the federal government has done. And the only reason they want to sell these lands off is to open them up for oil and gas drilling, mineral extraction, and timbering, even though the amount of revenue and employment that the oil and gas industry generates for the West is nothing compared to the outdoor recreation industry.
And what about the outdoor recreation industry in Pennsylvania? How does it benefit from this program?
This is big business now. The Outdoor Recreation Outdoor Industry Association estimates that recreation generates $29 billion in consumer spending in Pennsylvania, supporting 250,000 jobs all across the state. I mean, that's big business.
Ed Perry is the Pennsylvania Outreach Coordinator for the National Wildlife Federation. Perry says the Trump administration's proposed budget nearly zeros out the Land and Water Conservation Fund. He and others are lobbying Congress to permanently reauthorize it and fully fund it at $900 million a year. U.S. Senator Bob Casey of Pennsylvania supports that. There's more at AlleghenyFront.org. This is the Allegheny Front. I'm Carol Holsapple. Did you know that native orchids grow in our region? I didn't. This last story is about a new species of orchid that was discovered in West Virginia a few years ago. Two orchid enthusiasts found a previously undiscovered species known as Shriver's purple frilly orchid. Last summer, Roxy Todd traveled with them along the Highland Scenic Highway in Pocahontas County, West Virginia, to have a look at one of the Mountain State's little-known botanical treasures.
I was sworn to secrecy not to reveal the location of our hike before they agreed to take me to see one of the rare orchids. After all, poachers have been known to dig them up. Let's just say we took a little walk along a road to a steep hillside in the misty mountains of Pocahontas County.
We are in a grassy area between the side of the road and the boreal forest that is common to the highlands of West Virginia.
This is Scott Shriver, a retired high school biology teacher from Pittsburgh, who helped discover the purple frilly orchid and named it after his dad.
He was my dad, and I think he was probably my best friend for 30 years. I really, you know, wanted to honor him, and so I asked if we could name it after him. He died in 2008. We published in 2008, and so it was a kind of a tribute to him.
A report about the new species was published in the North American Native Orchid Journal. But aside from a few orchid fans and scientists, few people heard about the discovery.
You know, as a school teacher, I would tell the kids that I actually participated in the naming of a new species. And so a lot of the kids would say, well, how much money did you get for that? Or, you know, how famous are you? And I'm like, no, there's no money. There's no fame.
The ground is spongy and mossy under our feet as we make our way down a hillside covered in green ferns and tall grass. Scott and his friend Cleet Smith, who helped discover the purple frilly, are on the hunt for the orchid they discovered. Then we spot them. Each of the plants have lots of little purple flowers, each shaped like an orchid with a kind of a funny hat on top and a frilly ornamental skirt at its base.
The group of flowers on that stalk is called a raceme. And sometimes they'll have 40 or 50 flowers crowded very closely together. So each individual flower is no bigger than, say, maybe a nickel or maybe a quarter in some of the bigger ones. But if you get 100 of those all together on one raceme, it makes a pretty impressive display. So a lot of people would be excited to see that, and hopefully they wouldn't pick it, but it would be something that would be attractive to people who are pickers or what have you.
And then they see something they didn't expect to find.
Here's a Lassera.
I'll be darned. Where? I don't see it.
You see this one there? Oh, there it is.
They find a related species, a green orchid, right next to a very rare hybrid version. Basically, they think the green orchid crossed with the purple frilly they discovered to make a sort of orchid love child that has this cool green and purple color combination.
We found the other parent. So when this orchid, this green one, crosses with one of the purple Shriveris, boom, that's what you get. And that's Well, it's a hybrid.
For these two orchid fans, this is like Christmas in July.
It's a treasure hunt. There's no doubt. It's treasure.
Scott and Cleet are part of an informal group of orchid hobbyists who scour the country looking for these wildflowers.
We just fell in love with orchids and we hunted them. I mean, we hunted them from Alaska to Newfoundland. I mean, North American orchids were our hobby. Some people play golf. We did North American orchids. So we were just orchid crazy.
West Virginia has a really good climate and geography for orchids, making it a secret hotbed for finding a lot of different types of flowers. So Cleet and Scott began making regular trips to visit. They even made a goal to see an orchid in every county in the state, and they did.
I mean, I know there's been a lot of cutting of forests, there's been coal mining, there's been a lot of damage that has occurred here, but there's a lot of little nooks and crannies that still exist here that are fairly pristine.
They found that many of the best places to see orchids are in the Monongahela National Forest, 300,000 acres of which are located in Pocahontas County.
And so we were drawn to Pocahontas County because it was like the pinnacle of orchids. You could see 18 or 20 species in one day in bloom.
Orchids even grow in places where you might not think to see them.
And some of the orchids love those pristine niches. Other orchids
love disturbed areas.
Like disturbed areas, like old strip mines is one of our favorite places to go orchiding. Not a strip mine that ended 2 years ago, but one that ended 30 years ago and is recovering by succession. Orchids are going to move into those areas. So West Virginia is just a great place. Pennsylvania's good. West Virginia's probably better. And so we spend a lot of time here.
Neither Scott nor Cleet are professional botanists, but they insist that anyone with an interest in exploring the outdoors can make big discoveries, especially in remote Appalachia.
I think there's stuff in the nooks and crannies of West Virginia that no one's ever seen or described before, and that's exciting. When you're here, it's kind of like you've escaped urban and suburban areas, and in a lot of places in West Virginia, it's wild.
But this abundantly diverse wildness is fragile. Deer are a threat to orchids, and there are poachers who steal them to grow in greenhouses or to plant in their backyards. Recently, an endangered orchid that grows on Sheep Mountain was nearly wiped out by poachers. So I assure Cleet and Scott, their secret is safe with me. If you want to find an orchid, you'll have to go driving out to the mountains yourself. Keep your eyes peeled, though, because you never know what you'll find on the back roads of West Virginia. For the Allegheny Front, I'm Roxy Todd in Pocahontas County, West Virginia.
Thanks to West Virginia Public Broadcasting and their podcast Inside Appalachia for that story. You can find more from their series about hidden gems in the mountains of Appalachia on their website, wvpublic.org. And of course, we're online at AlleghenyFront.org and on Twitter at AlleghenyFront. Thanks for joining us on the Allegheny Front. Kathy Naur is the executive producer of our show. I'm Kara Holsapple.
Support for the Allegheny Front comes from the Heinz Endowments, the Pittsburgh Foundation, and the Park Foundation. The Richard King Mellon Foundation supports our coverage of conservation. State Impact Pennsylvania is a collaboration among the Allegheny Front, WESA, WITF, and WHYY to cover the Commonwealth's energy economy.